Okay, good morning. So, hello. So today we're going to be talking about some of the themes and ideas starting the conversation of Eden Robinson's Monkey Beach. For anyone who's in English literature, let me warn you right now that I do not do literary commentary. So I may well approach this book differently than you would in an English lit class. So who knows? We never know how those things go. But the reason I have you read, or I want you to read this, is for a different reason than you may well do in an English literature class. What I'm interested in are some of the ways in which, in an approachable way, this book presents some of the themes, some of the ideas, and allows for a way to empathize or try to actually experience, in some sense, through fiction, the actual material and real things that we're talking about in this class. So very oftentimes, the academic paper will present you with a rather staid, objective, or at least the author might think objective, account of something that lacks some of the sense of actually being there, the way it feels, the way one experiences it, the way one actually can think, and even some of the sensory aspects of the experience of these situations that are brought up here. Of course, it's also possible that if you don't actually know the landscape, don't necessarily happen to experience some of the things talked about here, it's quite possible that you may well not have experienced the book in the same way that I do, or somebody who actually comes from this area or knows these situations or has been through this landscape. So that's a possibility. Oftentimes, if fiction or any kind of writing or film for that matter speaks to people differently depending upon our own particular experiences. And so it may well be that some of my assumptions about what it just stands out so obviously in this text won't be the things that stand out to others who don't share a similar kind of background or experience as myself. And the part of what I want to talk about or highlight some of the things that I think are important from our coursework that we're going for in terms of what we're looking at here in this class, and we'll talk about that today. Next day, I will be away, but Adam will be here, and we'll be continuing the conversation of this book, focusing on some of the other aspects and issues that emerge from it. There's a number of themes that we want to talk about. I will talk about one set today, and then there'll be another set next day that we'll talk about, and then we'll have a discussion period on Friday, which will engage partially with the discussion of this book and partially an opportunity to dedicate some of your group project work coming that you'll be engaged in. And then, of course, following that, you have the reading break. Keep in mind that Monday is now a statutory holiday in British Columbia, so there are no officially scheduled courses this coming Monday. What do you mean, yay? Anyway, just in case, because it's quite likely that some of us may, I spent a lot of my youth in the commercial fishing industry growing up in family boats, and I spent all my summers fishing, and it was really quite late in life when I realized that there were such things as holidays in the summer. I just didn't understand that concept, and I would actually turn up to places when everybody else was closed down. Sometimes you don't recognize. Okay. Today, I want to highlight three particular themes that come up in this book. I'm going to outline them, but this is to take note. The theme of politics, ideas of economy, and then notions of the social landscape. And we'll talk a bit what I mean about that. So last class we talked a little bit about politics of colonialism and decolonization. There's also discussions of politics in this book that picks up some of these similar themes, as well as introduces some that might be a bit different from what I talked about last day in the lecture. There is an awful lot of discussion about economics in this book, in this novel, that references to some of the materials we talked about in terms of natural resource economy. We see, Kitimat right now is in the center, just 15 years ago when this book was published. Kitimat came from a long history, had a long history of industrial development back and forth. This Kitimat remains a hot spot of economic development. And we'll talk a little bit about that and the idea of energy movements through this area. And then the notion of social landscape, and here I'm referring to the way in which we as social beings overlie the physical environmental landscape with our own kind of social landscape, with places, both physical places and intangible places have meaning and relationships, and I have definition, and I'll talk a bit about that. Now, I put up here two types of politics in the book. Customary practices, focusing in Haisla society, the idea of the settlement feast, the notion of the feast cycle, which is a long-standing traditional practice through most of the indigenous societies in British Columbia, have some aspect of this sequence idea of feast, which is not simply the aspect of food. Sometimes you'll hear the term potlatch used. Other times you'll hear the local indigenous term used. It's not simply the matter of sharing and serving and partaking of the consumption of food. But there are elements that are similar. I don't know if anyone ever read the Brian Jakes stories when you were youth. My boys did, and I read them to them. And those characters were always having feasts amongst everything. And that was providing this kind of jovial, convivial, celebratory, constantly. That's the notion. That's not the notion. These are a social institution in which work is done. By work, I mean the important cultural and social work to maintain the continuity of this community. So when names are placed upon people, they occur in this public setting in which the feast recognizes, and people who attend are witnessing the event, and by their presence, and if they stand up and speak by what they say, are validating and ensuring the continuity of the social institution. Very often today, this notion of feast has been moved forward, and many different types of events become recognized through the feast situation. But it also becomes a point of perhaps misconception or a misunderstanding between non-Indigenous and Indigenous society. So if you go way back to the early contact a couple hundred years ago, where the American sailing ships came in and they described the feasts that were being held, that was a particular type of feast that was a declarative statement of proprietary rights and the obligations. The European ships' captains and crews really didn't get it, or if they got it, they often didn't follow those protocols. And they thought it an interesting and intriguing event to have participated in, but very often they didn't make the connection between or they really didn't get the connection between the feast and then their continued theft and removal of resources without adequate compensation. So Colonnette goes and catches fish, breaks down fishing weirs in and around Kakatla territory, and he gets a bit peeved when people start attacking him and removing iron particles and pieces from the boats, which from a Kakatla perspective was seen as fair compensation for the fish that was being taken without permission. Move forward to this day, you oftentimes see where there's a kind of notion that in our political world, in terms of the wider political world, people will go and kind of celebrate things, but they don't necessarily see the celebration, the political celebration of an event, as necessarily binding them to anything. It's kind of interesting dynamic. That people, the sort of mainstream liberal politics allow for people to come together, share a meal, have comments, make speeches about things, but it doesn't actually mean they're agreeing to it. So, for example, Kakatla had a piece some years ago which he referred to as Bachlantz, by the pulling together, and they invited a whole range of people to come to this particular celebration, this particular type of this feast. And it was a declaration of Kakatla's claim over a particular area that was being subjected to industrial development. Now, two things are very important to note here. First of all, the First Nations communities that disagreed with Kakatla were invited, but they didn't turn up. Okay? The government officials who didn't agree with Kakatla, almost to a letter, all turned up. And they all stood up and spoke and said, this is really important. This is a very important movement. We like what we're hearing here. This is, we really appreciate your hospitality. And what they were actually saying within the local structure is, we agree with what you're saying. We are standing up and serving witness to what you're saying. We're accepting this. Of course, they weren't saying that because they left immediately on a... In fact, they had a helicopter chartered for some of the oil company officials so they could get back to catch their keep their schedule in place, and left halfway through the speeches that the hereditary leadership was giving, which was seen to be a major affront in the local politics. But you have two systems of understanding coming together. One is the customary practice of the fee system. In that case, used to celebrate, it was a declarative feast. What is talked about in even Robinson's novel, The Faith, the settlement feast, the talking about the moving at the end of a person's life and the transferring of rights and prerogatives from one person to another, with, and is publicly recognized. And it's a form of politics about who comes, who doesn't come. Interesting point in terms of this type of politics is often dissent is expressed through absence or silence. Mainstream liberal individualist society, we have a notion that if you don't say something, you're acquiescing. Right? One of the things people will say, well, you had a lot of chance to say something if you didn't like it. University here on campus typically through its consultative processes will list, only four people came to the workshop. Nobody has any concern about this. We only received 10 emails, and the complaints were minor. So mainstream liberal democracy seems to focus on the idea that dissent is only represented through vocal, explicit statements, whereas you often see this notion of dissent is the absence of presence. It's because, of course, if you can't actually pass forward a name, if you don't have all the appropriate people standing there to witness the transferring of a name. Doesn't mean people don't have heated words in public settings. It doesn't mean that there aren't points of disagreement that are expressed, but it often is talked out over a long period of time. The other type of politics that's talked about in the book is a newer form of politics. I refer to it here as new social movements. Anyone in sociology or political science, depending upon the brand of political science, will probably have encountered the idea of new social movements. It had to do with the idea social movements being large, like the old ones were like the labor movements, trade union organization, that kind of idea. The new movements focusing around issues of identity politics, sexual politics, gender politics. Seemed to arise with the new left of the late 60s and 70s. And here you see where the uncle who is involved in the American Indian movement, AIM, which was a classic political movement that came out of the 60s and 70s particularly, but lasted through the 70s, was tied to a similar kind of politics as the Black Panther. Perhaps not as not the same. There's variations. Maybe if I say it that way, people, if you only have a superficial knowledge, might think just kind of the popular aspects of violent insurrection. But when I say it, it's politics about empowerment and taking control and dealing with issues of social oppression by self-governance and self-autonomy, and then tied to a kind of pan-community organization. And you see that discussed in the book. So that's the type of politics that are raised in this book. And you get some very interesting counterpoints, how these different politics clash with each other, and then times meld with each other. It's very nicely presented in that particular case there. Now, I've kind of gone and sort of created these dichotomous pairings of these things into politics and economy, and it's never this simple, but it helps as an interpretive frame. So you have the industrial, I've divided like the industrial economy and the customary economy. Actually, the book doesn't come up to the idea of Enbridge and LNG, but it's that really ties into the Elkan approach. So you get some very nice accounts and descriptions. It's embedded within the process of the role through the 20th century of the industrial resource economy. Engagement of logging, a lot of people involved in hand logging and small scale falling in this community. There's a doctoral dissertation that was done in this department, in the anthropology department in 1977 by a man called John Pritchard, that documents in quite a fine detail. He did his research in the mid 70s, so we're talking, let's see, 80s, 90s, 35 odd years ago, so things have changed a lot. But what he documented at that point in time shows the extent of late 19th century, early 20th century, mid 20th century involvement in the industrial economy, where logging and fishing were key activities. Kitimat Village, the Heisman community, is of course right at the head of the long inlet that goes straight out into some of the critical, very important commercial fishing areas today mostly today the salmon is dog salmon. You probably know dog salmon as chum salmon because it's typically on the boats do we call them dog salmon because it's a big teeth. They're about 10-15 pound fish. They get these great big, when they start turning to go up the river, they get these kind of wild kind of green black color with purpley kind of rainbow stripes along the side. People from the Kitimat Village also worked as far down as the first pulp mill that was in the BC coast at Swanson's Bay. It's on the inside passage. If you ever take the ferry up from Port Hardy to Prince Rupert, you're getting up toward Prince Rupert, you'll have. Now, often the ferry would tell people where Butedale is. Butedale is an old, collapsing cannery on the north coast. They have a great big hydro plant that up until a few years ago, they just kept the turbines kept running, and they had the lights on there, even though there was just a caretaker living there. It's completely falling into the water, like a lot of these places are today. About 10-15 miles or so south of that place is Swanson Bay, and you can still see some of this brick chimney behind. It had a sawmill, a pulp mill, had a school. You can find the school records for it. A lot of the logs that were processed there, a good portion of them came from Aboriginal communities from Clem Two to the south, Hartley Bay just a little bit to the north, Heisla hand loggers coming down from Kitimat. Into that area. There's this one series of telegrams between the plant manager and the owners based in Vancouver saying what was he supposed to do? Could he be authorized to cut a check? Because he had about 50 or 60 Aboriginal hand loggers tied up the dock with booms of logs, and they needed the logs, but the company was having a little bit of cash flow problems. It was in the early 20s. And they kept sending telegrams back and forth trying to get authorization because he knew in order to keep his supply going, he had to give some money. And the company guys were trying to hold back the money from Vancouver. It's a classic kind of scenario. So that they were involved there at working at plants at Swanson's Bay as well as harvesting timber for it. And then when Elkan began, a number of people worked. Not a lot of people, but a number of people worked there. Elkan did one of the classic things that large-scale transnational companies do. They went and recruited workers offshore. So most of the early workers came either Portugal, Germany, or India. who worked in that mill, and to this, and they did this kind of classic organization from a wave rather than looking to any of the local areas. Today we see, of course, it's not in the book because it wasn't on the agenda at that point in time. We see this emergence of the liquid natural gas plant. Haisla has actually signed an agreement with some of the LNG plants or companies to facilitate that as a counterpoint against the Enbridge things. They've been quite opposed to the tar sands exporting, and in the process of being opposed to tar sands, have signed a letter of agreement with one of the companies. I think it's the Malaysian-run company, if memory serves correct. These things have gone through these rollovers and names and various different part players. It's hard to keep track of what their actual current official name is. On the other side, the book also talks about engagement in the so-called customary economy, the economy that's been persistent. But as we know, the part of that goes way back several millennia. But in addition, we also know from the different readings and materials that there's been a legal structure put in place that's narrowed the scope of the so-called customary economy and has actually made it such that it's limited its capacity to a certain extent. But you have some very nice descriptions. I put some up here on the pages. Page 76-77. So we had this discussion. When the salmon berries came out, we picked two buckets. I like to pick out the red ones because the sweetness depends on the color of the berry, with red being the sweetest, orange less sweet, and yellow the mildest. Ripe berries can be as long as the tip of your thumb and are best picked before they become mushy. People who haven't grown up with salmon berries call the taste watery and seedy. I think of the taste as a soft sweetness, a gentle flavor. Hand-high salmon berry shoots unfold from the tight fronds, serrated raspberry-like leaves unfurled as the shoots became stalks and bushes. Hard, nubby buds opened into five-petaled hot pink flowers about the diameter of a quarter. The petals formed a deep cup with a fuzzy yellow center with a heavy, zingy nectar sparkle. As the petals fell, salmon berries poked through. They started off green and hard, looking like unripe blackberries. They plumped up and softened with the rain and ripened in the sun, suffusing jewel bright red, orange, or yellow, glowing against the green of the bush. And on we go. The more description of thimble berries. And then we picked berries for Mamau. Then she made salmon berry stews. When we had a big bucket full of salmon berries and thimble berries, we'd bring them to her, and she'd soak them in a large pot with cold water and a bit of salt to chase the bugs out. She'd open her jars of blueberries and huckleberries, then leave them on the table. We'd sit in her living room while the fresh berries were soaking and watch The Young and the Restless, All My Children, or In the Evening Dynasty. But all through the book is the descriptions of these types of practices of harvesting, and both the possibility and the desire and the sort of the element of nostalgia and contemporary practice linking to it. And then it's set in this wider frame where this kind of industrial machinery of production is moving along and accompanied with these kind of newer practices as well. Linked to this, we see discussions of customary or traditional ecological knowledge. Just take a look at page 150 to 52. Won't read it all. Okay, look, she said. See the fish bones? It's really fattening up for winter. Grouse, I said. You can tell where the bear's going to be by its scat. Berry seeds, it's up in the bush. Fish bones, it's down by the river. It's still gross. You kids these days. After another half hour of slogging, she stopped in front of a plant as tall as her, with broad, smooth leaves that branched off the stalk like a tulip's leaves. It was topped with tiny white flowers. Just watch, she said, handing me the rifle. She took the shovel and started digging a big hole around the plant. When she hit the root, she started digging with her hands. The root had a small dark bulb, but then it went stringy like a creamy yellow moth. When she'd exposed enough of the root, she began tugging until it came loose. She brushed off the dirt and motioned me to come closer. Oaxaca, she said, powerful medicine, very dangerous. It can kill you, do you understand? You have to respect it. She handed me the root and I put it in the bucket. There were some more bushes around, but she said to let them be. We slogged some more, found two suitable plants. Then she declared we had enough. You put those on your windowsill and it keeps ghosts away. And then she goes on. So here's an account talking about a harvesting of a particular plant for both medicinal and spiritual purposes. And all through the book there's these discussions, so the knowledge to recognize that something that which may be dangerous or poisonous can have a use, but then you need to know how to use it, in what way. And this is something that you don't just learn by flipping through a book, but sometimes we can do it. But you have to learn through practice and observation. Has anyone ever picked mushrooms? A couple people? A few people? And is it sometimes possible to confuse poisonous with edible? Yeah, you really need to know. You have to be careful. Poisonous mushrooms, the ones that, you're lucky if they're just the ones that make you a little bit ill and sick to the stomach. But you really, it's kind of a practice skill of engagement, of moving, of observation, of knowing where to go. And there's oftentimes, even for finding certain things, it's understanding the type of signs or things that you look for. So for example, people harvesting pine mushrooms, which I've never done. I've never actually harvested pine mushrooms, so I'm only repeating what other people have told me about the pine mushrooms and what I've observed following people who are picking pine mushrooms, is that you can see by the way other animals behave. So, for example, the squirrel that is moving, a pine squirrel that's moving through an area and it wants to keep you out of a place is telling you something. Or the way the bears are moving through the forest and in certain areas have scratched the ground and uncovered things. You can, by identifying other people's behaviors, other animals' behaviors, other social beings' practices within the forest gate, it can actually help you identify the places to go. But you only know that through that practice, observation, watching, and engagement. And that's part of this customary economy. It's not. This is part of what's being described in these accounts, are the knowledge that's required and needed in order to do the harvesting. So you have here, in one sense, the description, say, of salmon berries or of this medicinal plant and what it looks like and what it smells like, what it tastes like. But you also have what's being conducted, is the knowledge system around it. How to find it, how to process it, what it's used for. That kind of knowledge is critical, because it's one thing to be able to identify, say, a berry, but if you don't know how to process it properly or what it's used for, it's not much good. I mean, one of the things I find around this campus is one of the favorite planting is something that in Sinhala is called jawes. The English word used for it is salal. It's used in ornamental all over campus, in all kinds of different residential areas, and it's an amazingly delicious berry that just basically sits there on the vine and goes soft. But you need to know how to process it, and that's, most people look at it and don't necessarily consider that it's edible or even a fruit. It might be seen to be perhaps a bit of a nuisance because it leaves great big blue stains all over the ground if you have any cement underneath it, etc. So it's kind of knowing what things are and how to use them is part of this process. Social landscape. So different styles of writing, different ways of making sense of our world, have different kind of conventions. Recently, I was involved with a group of archaeologists everyone was writing papers for a special edited collection of a journal. And it was very interesting to see each of the archaeology papers almost invariably began with a ecological description. A description of the landscape, of the plants, of the climate. Meanwhile, my own paper, which stood out, began with a story about what I remember as a kid seeing abalone being cooked up on the kitchen table, or it being prepared at home, and that kind of thing. I was using archaeological data, but my way of thinking about how to place it was in a different context. But this is part of this. You could suggest that the archaeological social landscape is one that begins from first saying, where is the physical ground? What does it look like? What are the environmental factors? But here, from this perspective that Eden Robinson is writing about in Monkey Beach, the social landscape, here is this, these particular places where life is lived, both the notion of traditional life, the practices of being Haisla in the past, as well as the present, the way in which people's relationships to each other are understood. I recall in a conversation with a man called Gerald Amos, who at the time was the chief counselor of the Haisla Nation, was talking about going up with his aunts and his uncles and family to the Kitlo for ulukan fishing, and how there was this one place when they came to on this trip that the older women would start to sing a very particular song. And that's the only place you'd ever hear that song, and the only time you would have is on that kind of trip, and it was tied to a place that defines, in a sense, the social landscape. So there's a marker, a physical marker on the land, but there's an idea, there's a history for why that song would be sung there. There's a history that's partially embedded in the song itself, but also in the understanding of the story, the history behind it, and in terms of what actually happened to that place, as well as the need to recognize it. So it becomes part of the social landscape. It's actually an elaboration of a physical landscape, one might say. There's also, the history of colonialism is also about the change and the transformation in the social landscape. So in a certain sense, you can have simultaneously one physical place, or one, you've got, for linguistic simplicity, one physical space that is multiple social places. Here we have Kitimat and Kitimat. You know, the road between the, you know, where you have, and there's different ways of spelling it, but this emphasizes the idea, the anglicized version of Kitimat with the eyes, and then the transformation, how you get this little highway separating between the non-indigenous primary city and town versus the indigenous community. So that's one level, the same word. Also, if you take a marine atlas of this coast, one of those annotated marine atlases that always have big letters saying, do not use for navigable purposes, but just about everyone uses them for navigating up and down the coast. The annotated ones describe all the place names. And one of my, I don't think favorite's the right word to put it, but it is a favorite, is Conus Islet, named after a fox terrier of one of the ship's officers of a sailing ship. Okay. That had a name before that, an indigenous name before that. But if you go up and down the coast, you see the restructuring, the renaming of the social landscape. So now we have Sarah Head, Princess Royal Island, Porcher Island, Vancouver Island, Fraser River. We have, you know, Noble Mountain, Lion's Gate. You start seeing that the names that start becoming laid down, and some of them it's a restructuring, a rewriting, a reinscription of a landscape, a new creation of a new social landscape through the act of naming and silencing the names that were there before. So you see the discussions of that throughout the book. There's references to this notion of the social landscape and these changes and what the implications are. Because what it does, if you think back to Jim McDonald's paper about the idea for Kitson Kalem and that sort of underdevelopment, where without leaving their home, they shifted from being part of the economy to apart from the mainstream economy. So there is a displacement where people are made to be away. Now we look at naming. Naming makes you renaming makes one a stranger in their own place, where it unsettles and disrupts a person's sense of location and connection. It also, in that context, there's a positive side to it as well. It also means that you also have an in group language of communication that ties you to places. So a lot of the guys who spoke Somalic, the older gentlemen in the commercial fishing from Simpson communities, would speak on the radio phones telling each other in Somalic, comparing fishing notes. So it allowed that kind of positive side, except that because of the overarching dominant structure of displacement that was going on, it affected the transmission of language. And so what it means is that there's a changing. So the younger generation becomes more and more prone to learn the newly inscribed names, which make people strangers or estrange them or, you know, alienate them within one's own place. So that's part of this changing of places. It's both physical. There's a physical change to the structure. So you put an aluminum smelter at a pulp mill in a head of a fjord, which has a kind of very unique sort of airshed qualities. You increase acid rain, which is actually, this is one of the biggest places, the problems of acid rain in Western Canada. The whole rain shadow zone behind the pulp mill, which I believe is shut down now, which is going to be one of the sites for one of the LNG plants. The materials from the smelter that goes up there, all this kind of transforming that's happening. It also affects not just this particular area, but has a wider reach, that industrial change. So the construction of canals tied to various types of major river diversions all through the water stream has a reach all the way up into the Fraser River system and the Skeena River systems by default. By shifting water and moving things, you change water, core water temperatures, which has, even if you change things by a couple of degrees, has a major impact. It also affects the Ulican Run in the Camano River, changes the erosion patterns. Something as simple as putting a dock to tend to access Camano for the construction of Camano actually changes the way the water flow is going and then affects the ability of Ulican to spawn. Ulican are an interesting fish, just a little side note on Ulican. Ulican typically spawn in what are called glacial freshets, creeks or rivers or streams that actually have glacial melt pouring down. And if you look at all the ones that's up from the furthest southern extreme all the way up, they're almost practically, those are the ones you have that have a glacial runoff of some sort, which has it has potential implications when you think of the impact of global warming and the massive reduction of the ice fields that have been occurring. But in this social landscape is also this idea, this connection to ancient places. Now, it's one of the things that I've noticed myself as well. When I use archaeology as an example, but it's only because it's something I've been interested in myself the last 4 or 5 years, exploring, delving into in more detail. There is within archaeology a language the same that's in the classic Western science. The Enlightenment science model of discovery, of this notion that you're going to go forward through a rigorous scientific method and find new things that have not been found before, and then you're going to do research upon those new things. In Kala territory, when we went to visit different sites and places and we were doing the looking for places, we essentially revisited places that people not just had been in the past going to, but oftentimes people continue to use and visit all the time. Usage changed, so maybe today a place that somebody visits in the bottom end of Banks Island is no longer a major village with 500 to 750 or so people living in it year round. It now is a place that somebody anchors off of. Up until the 60s, maybe they had a trapping cabin. Now they go and visit there on an annual basis to do something. But it's still used. It's still part of the living memory, the social landscape of how the place is thought of. So it's not an undiscovered landscape. When you have people living in a space for 10,000 years or more, you have to think that it's really not remote, isolated, unknown. And the question becomes, perhaps it's the perspective one's looking at it, where something is unknown. So there's this connection, and then you see, I have this quote here, behind us the village, the road to town, the hazy plumes of smoke, and the bright orange lights of Alcan shrank away. Ahead of us, the mountain stretched along the sides of the channels. Okay, why did I quote that one? Hold on a minute here. That doesn't sound like community and connection to place. I think it's because of what's said before that and after that. Ah, yes. Because they're casting off the boat. They're going from the village. It's like you're leaving this one particular place that has been marked and transformed with the industrial plant and the impact of Alcan and all those transformations. And as you're moving forward with that behind, it's almost as though that you can shift your perspective. And it's the same mountains that have always been there in that particular way that have the histories and stories that you're connected to. And that idea of, when I mentioned with the archaeologists where we went, you know, the notion of discovery, but in fact with the archaeology projects, we're actually revisiting and returning to places, learning new things or different things about them through a new tool. But it's that idea that there's this continuing connection. So even in the face of transformation and disruption, there are continuities and connections. But keep in mind, this is a kind of puzzling dichotomy, one which recently I've been trying to work through, because we often pair this notion for either you have transformation, disruption here, continuity and continuation here, and persistence, and these kind of notions. And it's often phrased as though these are two different things. And no human society or culture ever exists without change or transformation. Sometimes this rate of change and transformation is slower, sometimes it's faster. And there are times when there are complete discontinuities between past and future. There are moments where things click over and that it is a massive restructuring in some way. But in the narrative of looking at the social landscape within the indigenous communities, I think we need to find a better mechanism than this simply disruption transformation over here versus continuity over here. Because what happens is in the school that talks about continuity and persistence, the argument is that there is a something that essentially has never changed. It's enduring, it's pure, and it's been that way forever from the moment it first arose to now. And I'm not sure that that is correct. I mean, that has elements of... I was going to say elements of religion, but I don't quite mean that in the right way. There's elements of which it shifts to an ideal belief system that is disarticulated from the actual real world within which people live. On the other hand, the people who argue about transformation disruption very typically suggest that everything is fundamentally changed. So even if people can remember the past, it's so different. It's really something new and something else. And there's a problem with that too, because if people can remember the past and do recount the past, going back millennia and generations, etc., well, yes, there's change, yes, there's disruption, but something is being continued there. So you need the element. But the difficulty is in these kind of polemicized, dichotomous debates. They kind of emphasize how different each side is. And what is more the case is that there are these aspects which, in the same way, I think that, and this is why I have this quote here, this one on page 91, there's a sense to which even that we have these both are acting all at the same time. Disruption, displacement, and continuity simultaneously. And that as human beings, we construct narratives that interlace these past and possible futures. And where you have a final closing is when people are unable to weave a narrative forward, where people can't perceive a possibility of future, where they move to a state where there is a belief there's a fundamental lack of hope or possibility. And that's what ends it, with the inability to conceive of a possible future. And in some situations, that's what has happened, where people, and where the most difficult situations, where the horrendous situations of crisis occur is when where people have found an inability to conceive of the possibility of future. The individual parallel to that, the individual example, is the issue of suicide. When people feel that there is no point but to end their own life, that notion, that's the individual personal parallel of a societal thing. And it's a similar kind of psychological idea, in one sense, of the inability to envision a possible continuing on to the future. And I think that Eden Robinson's book navigates between these two ideas in a nice way, between the idea of pure continuity and total disruption and transformation. And she does so by exploring notions of trauma as well at the root of this, which is oftentimes ignored. And when we look at the Reconciliation and Indignation book, we'll also look at some of these notions about the impact of trauma and disruption and how people then construct and narratives that can navigate forward in those contexts. And what is interesting to me in this particular book and what it says about this particular issue is that there is a possibility, though, of course, as in all good fiction, I suppose you could say, she really doesn't give us an ending. It's the ending that my father used to say, because we grew up with a one-channel, black-and-white TV context, probably unheard of concept for most of the people in the room. And my father always called certain types of movies a CBC movie. When they, from CBC, actually made erudite, interesting television production, that basically meant there was no ending, no clear closure, no resolution, no pat answer provided. It was a CBC ending. And I guess you could say she's provided us with a CBC ending of sorts. So on next Wednesday, we'll continue this conversation more, though we'll continue it through the voice of Adam. And you'll have a discussion on Friday focusing on these themes as well. Have a good weekend.